This is VOA's International Edition. Some of the stories that we'll be covering in the next 30 minutes. Ukraine has a new government featuring several ministers with foreign nationalities. A U.S. senator says Hong Kong should not have to wait any longer for genuine democracy. Israel gets set for early elections. And we'll look at allegations that North Korea carried out a computer hacking attack on a U.S. movie studio in revenge for a film mocking its leader, Kim Jong-un. I'm Michael Lippin. Thanks for joining us. Ukraine's parliament has approved a new pro-Western government. On Tuesday, Ukrainian lawmakers voted in favor of putting several foreigners in key financial roles, as Kiev tries to resuscitate an economy weakened by a separatist rebellion near the Russian border. The foreigners were granted Ukrainian citizenship by presidential decree. They include U.S. national Natalie Jureczko, who will serve as finance minister. She joins Lithuanian investment banker Avaras Abromavičius, who will serve as economy minister. The new cabinet of Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk took shape as government troops and pro-Russian rebels announced another ceasefire in their 8-month battle for control of eastern Ukraine. It was the second truce declaration in recent months. But there were reports late Tuesday of renewed shelling near a key airport in the rebel-controlled eastern region of Donetsk. Russia is predicting that its economy will slide into recession next year. The Russian Economic Development Ministry said Tuesday the economy is likely to contract by 0.8% in 2015. Previously, it expected economic growth of 1.2% for next year. Several factors were behind the downgrade in Russia's economic prospects, including falling revenues from oil exports that are vital to the state budget. Western financial sanctions linked to Russia's intervention in Ukraine also have hurt the banking sector and contributed to a drop in foreign investment. The value of the Russian ruble also has dropped by more than 40% against the U.S. dollar this year. A prominent U.S. senator says the Obama administration should do more to press Hong Kong authorities to respond to the demands of pro-democracy protesters. The call by Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown comes as Hong Kong student activists vow to continue their occupations of city streets, despite a decision by older protest leaders to surrender to police. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns reports.
With student protesters in Hong Kong refusing to stand down following threats that police will now use more resolute action against them, it's time for the Obama administration to take a tougher line over the standoff, says U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown.
Our agreements with China, our clashes with China, our engagement with China.
Brown, who heads the Congressional Executive Commission on China, says he agrees with former Hong Kong Governor Chris Patten that Beijing has put in place a democracy like Iran's, where you can vote, but the leadership decides whom you can vote for.
That's not democracy. The people of Hong Kong shouldn't have to wait any longer.
The State Department has called for restraint and dialogue in Hong Kong. Brown says the United States has mistakenly tried to manage China's rise, hoping that its compliance with the rules would follow.
Blocking and censoring U.S. websites while Chinese tech companies raise billions on our capital markets should no longer be acceptable. Talking about having dialogue on human rights without releasing political prisoners, without shutting down the labor camps, without protecting workers, without respecting the rights of minorities, ethnic minorities shouldn't be tolerated.
Brown believes Saturday's elections in Taiwan were affected by the Hong Kong protests, as Taiwan's ruling pro-China party lost ground.
It was almost certainly a vote against closer engagement with China by the Taiwanese government, Taiwanese people.
The senator's call for greater U.S. support for Hong Kong protesters comes as some of their original leaders urge them to go home to avoid further violence.
A government that uses police batons to maintain its authority is a government that is beyond reason. For the sake of the occupiers' safety, for the sake of our original intention of love and peace, as we prepare to surrender, we free urge the students to retreat.
But leaving now, say the students, risks giving up on real change.
If we leave now, we cannot get anything, and we cannot ask for real election. and in the future. So if we leave now, we cannot do anything anymore.
That's a commitment that Senator Brown says deserves Washington's support and a change of approach to Beijing. Scott Stearns, VOA News at the State Department.
Lebanese security officials say the nation's military has detained a wife and child of the leader of the Islamic State militant group. The officials said Tuesday that Lebanese authorities were questioning the woman and child after detaining them about 10 days ago near the border with Syria, where they were carrying fake identification cards. Lebanon's As-Safir newspaper said the detentions were the result of a joint effort between Lebanese and foreign intelligence agencies. There was no immediate reaction from the Islamic State or its leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has called for early elections after firing two key ministers whom he accused of undermining his government. On Tuesday, Mr. Netanyahu, a nationalist, dismissed his centrist finance minister Yair Lapid and centrist justice minister Tzipi Livni. Lapid and Livni had disagreed with Mr. Netanyahu on several key issues, including a controversial Netanyahu-sponsored measure that would declare Israel as the nation-state of the Jewish people. Critics of the measure said it would undermine the democratic character of Israel, where 20% of the population is Arab. Supporters insisted that the principles of democracy and Jewish national rights would have the same importance. Infighting within the Israeli government also had intensified due to disputes about taxation policy and defense spending. French lawmakers have voted in favor of urging their government to recognize a Palestinian state, joining similar moves by lawmakers in Britain and Ireland. For VOA, Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
Je vais donc mettre au voie la proposition de résolution.
As expected, the measure urging French recognition of a Palestinian state sailed through France's lower house, the National Assembly, supported by the dominant left. The final tally, 339 deputy votes in favor to 151 votes against. The text asks the government to recognize the state of Palestine with a view to reaching a definite settlement to the Middle East conflict. Practically speaking, it carries no weight, but it offers a symbolic boost for the Palestinians. It also reflects growing European frustration over the lack of advancement in the peace process and anger at what is perceived as expansionist Israeli policies. France's main opposition UMP party voted against the measure.
Votre résolution, et vous le savez, elle est juridiquement nulle.
UMP National Assembly leader Christian Jacob said the vote only poured oil on the Middle East fire. Symbolically recognizing Palestine does not resolve anything, he said, and only increases tensions. In a statement, the Israeli embassy described the National Assembly vote as an error, but it said the French government's position for a negotiated solution to resolve the conflict remained unchanged. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Qatar has lifted a travel ban against an American couple who were prevented from leaving the Persian Gulf state despite being acquitted of charges in the death of their adopted daughter. The U.S. ambassador to Qatar, Dana Shell Smith, said Tuesday the couple would be allowed to leave on Wednesday. On Sunday, a Doha court overturned an earlier conviction against the Huangs. They originally had been jailed on murder charges in connection with the January 2013 death of their 8-year-old daughter Gloria, adopted from an orphanage in Ghana. Egypt's top prosecutor says he will appeal the acquittal of former President Hosni Mubarak of all charges in the deaths of anti-government demonstrators in 2011. The prosecutor's office said Tuesday the ruling was legally flawed. On Saturday, a Cairo court dropped murder charges against Mr. Mubarak, who was accused of conspiracy in the deaths of 239 anti-government demonstrators. His interior minister and six other top security officers accused of ordering the killings also were acquitted. The court also found that Mr. Mubarak and his sons Ala and Jamal were innocent of corruption charges, but the former president will remain in a prison hospital where he is serving a 3-year sentence on a separate embezzlement charge. Well, still to come on International Edition, we'll tell you who is favored to replace Chuck Hagel as the U.S. defense chief. Libyan officials say forces loyal to Libya's internationally recognized government have carried out airstrikes in the western part of the country, killing at least 7 people and wounding about 25 others. Local officials say the strikes in the town of Zuwara targeted a food depot, a chemical plant, and a fishing port. At least 5 workers were among those killed. Kenya's president, Uhuru Kenyatta, has replaced his interior minister and police chief hours after a militant attack killed 36 people. President Kenyatta said Tuesday he had fired Interior Minister Joseph Ole Lenku and accepted Police Chief David Kimayo's request to retire. Both officials had come under domestic criticism for failing to stop a series of attacks blamed on Islamic extremists. Somali militant group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the killings of 36 people in northeast Kenya earlier in the day. The attack happened at a quarry near the town of Mandera, where witnesses said the gunmen struck as workers were sleeping in their tents. Last month, Al-Shabaab gunmen killed 28 people in an attack in the same region. An Al-Shabaab statement said the fighters were punishing Kenya for sending troops to fight them in Somalia. White House officials have yet to name President Obama's choice for Secretary of Defense following the resignation last week of Chuck Hagel. But as VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez reports, all signs point to a former Pentagon official for the top job.
Long before an official announcement, reports quoted unidentified administration officials as saying President Obama has settled on Ashton Carter, a former number two official at the Pentagon. At Tuesday's regular briefing, White House spokesman Josh Earnest stopped short of confirming reports that Mr. Obama has chosen Carter for the job.
What I can tell you is not much. I don't have any personnel announcements to make today.
But Earnest had hearty praise for Carter, saying he had previously served very ably as Deputy Secretary of Defense and is one who fulfills a number of criteria, including experience in getting along with Congress.
He's somebody that certainly deserves and has demonstrated strong bipartisan support for his previous service in government. He's somebody that does have a detailed understanding of the way that the Department of Defense works.
The Obama administration hopes the new Secretary of Defense will do what Mr. Obama himself has been unable to do, find common ground with Congress. The relationship between the White House and Capitol Hill, already strained, is set to become even more difficult after Republicans won a majority in both chambers in the November elections. Analysts say the job of the new defense secretary will be no easier than it was for Chuck Hagel, who faced the challenge of fighting an unexpected war against the Islamic State with a shrinking budget. Ashton Carter has extensive experience in administering the Pentagon, but he is not a political figure and therefore does not appear to have any political aspirations that could put him on a collision course with the administration. Thomas Donnelly is a defense analyst with the American Enterprise Institute in Washington.
If you look at it from the White House's perspective, the qualifications are is they want somebody who will follow orders and not make waves. Seeing what happened to Secretary Hagel and Secretaries Panetta and Gates before him, the White House clearly wants somebody who's not going to push back too hard, particularly when it comes to warfighting issues.
Administration sources say the president approached a number of current and former senior officials who did not appear to be interested in the job. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, at the White House.
U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson defended President Obama's executive order on immigration Tuesday before the House Homeland Security Committee. VOA Cindy Sain reports from Capitol Hill about Republican Party anger over immigration that might affect a government funding bill that has to be passed by December 11th.
Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson remained outwardly cool and confident under a firestorm of questions about the president's executive action, which will shield some 4 million undocumented immigrants from deportation and grant them work permits if they register. Johnson said the executive action is not illegal and is not an amnesty, but will require those affected to come forward and register.
The reality is that, given our limited resources, these people are not and have not been for years priorities for removal. It's time we acknowledge that and encourage them to be held accountable. This is simple common sense.
Republicans on the panel said the president is destroying the trust of Congress and the American people by taking unilateral action to allow the parents of American citizen children to stay in the country and to get work permits. Secretary Johnson blamed House Republicans for not passing an immigration reform bill like the Senate did in 2013. That prompted this exchange between Johnson and Republican Representative Jeff Duncan.
I'd like to work with Congress on passing a bill. The president has said that would be his preference. The problem is we have no partner.
I think Congress can pass a bill when the American people start regaining trust in the administration to actually do their job and enforce the laws that are already on the books, and I yield back.
House Republicans met Tuesday to discuss how to counter the president's action. House Speaker John Boehner said this after the meeting.
Listen, we're looking at a number of options in terms of how do we address this. Now, this is a serious breach of our Constitution. It's a serious threat to our system of government. And frankly, we have limited options and limited abilities to deal with it directly. But that's why we're continuing to talk to our members. We've not made decisions about how we're going to proceed, but we are, in fact, going to proceed.
With less than 2 weeks until a planned holiday recess, both the House and the Senate need to pass government spending bills to avoid another shutdown like the one that happened in 2013. Some congressional aides say the House may vote as early as this week on a symbolic measure, saying the president cannot defer deportations, which is not likely to be taken up in the Senate. This would allow some Republican members to vent their frustration over immigration, while at the same time passing the spending bill to avoid another costly government shutdown. Cindy Sain, VOA News, on Capitol Hill.
U.S. President Obama is urging Congress to pass $6.2 billion in emergency funding to fight the Ebola virus before the holiday recess in a few weeks. Speaking at the National Institutes of Health in near Washington on Tuesday, Mr. Obama said money to battle the disease is running out. He said passing a bill would be a Christmas present from Congress to the American people and the world. He called it exciting news that there were no serious side effects during the first phase of clinical tests of a potential Ebola vaccine. He noted that no other Ebola drug has progressed this far to date. Despite the progress made in countries like Liberia, President Obama said the fight is far from over, noting that the outbreak has gotten worse in countries like Sierra Leone, where the death toll has risen in recent weeks.
And this can still spread to other countries, as we've seen in Mali. Every hot spot is an ember that, if not contained, can become a new fire. So we cannot let down our guard even for a minute. And we can't just fight this epidemic. We have to extinguish it.
Ebola has killed almost 7,000 people in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, along with a handful of people in other countries. HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, is frequently mutating. That has allowed the virus to bypass the immune system and infect about 80 million people over the last 35 years. But researchers say the rapid evolution of HIV actually may be reducing its ability to cause AIDS. VOA's Joe DiCapua explains.
Oxford University professor Philip Goulder is the lead scientist in the study.
One of the quintessential features of HIV is its ability to mutate and evade the best things we can throw at it, whether it's immune responses or antiretroviral drugs. That's its real strength.
But HIV is not omnipotent.
Even HIV has some weaknesses. The fact is there are some parts of the virus that really doesn't like to change. And one of these regions is the central core that encapsulates the two copies of the viral RNA and the various viral enzymes. That region of the virus can mutate, but if it mutates, it usually damages the ability of the virus to multiply, replicate efficiently.
RNA is a molecule necessary in the production of proteins that are essential for life. Goulder says the most effective responses to HIV target the capsid protein. It encloses the virus's nucleic acid, which allows the transfer of genetic information between different generations of the virus. HIV's many mutations take their toll.
The accumulation of these mutations over time effectively result in a diminution of the ability of the virus to infect cells efficiently and to cause disease. So that's a good thing.
HIV, he says, becomes less virulent, losing some ability to cause AIDS through the collapse of the immune system. But could HIV ever reach the point where it mutates into something that does not cause disease?
It is a bit speculative to say what's going to happen in 10 years or tens of decades. If the trend that we've seen in the last 10 years in Botswana were to continue, and I see no reason why it shouldn't, I think the number of people who can control the virus through their immune system would definitely go up or be expected to go up, and eventually could be some tens of decades down the track, the majority of people.
The research was based on the HIV-1 strain that typically infects people in southern Africa. Goulder points out that another strain of the virus, HIV-2, which occurs in West Africa, causes AIDS in a smaller fraction of people that it infects.
You know, it's not impossible to see HIV becoming less of a causer of disease, and that's what you see in the monkeys who are naturally infected with SIV. The relation of HIV, which is where we actually got HIV from, they suffer no disease at all.
SIV stands for simian immunodeficiency virus. Professor Goulder also says the greater use of antiretroviral drugs appears to affect the virulence of HIV. The drugs may accelerate the evolution of those HIV variations that have a weaker ability to replicate. The findings appear in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Goulder and his Oxford colleagues worked with scientists from South Africa, Canada, and Japan, as well as Harvard University and Microsoft Research. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation is looking into a cyber attack on U.S. film studio Sony Pictures Entertainment. The November 24th attack comes just weeks before Sony was set to release a comedy about an assassination plot against North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. So the question on many people's minds is, could North Korea be behind the hacking? VOA's Alex Villarreal has the story.
Undisguised terrorism. That's what North Korean officials have labeled Sony Pictures' upcoming movie, The Interview. Stars Seth Rogen and James Franco play journalists recruited by the CIA to kill North Korean leader Kim Jong-un.
You want us to kill the leader of North Korea?
Yes.
What?
So after Sony got hacked last week, news the company is looking into possible North Korean involvement did not come as a surprise. North Korea already complained to the United Nations and the White House about the movie, but would it wage cyber war over it? Frank Salufo heads the Homeland Security Policy Institute at the George Washington University, and he says yes.
They certainly have both the motive and the capability. They made their intentions loud and clear when the foreign ministry threatened that they will mercilessly destroy anyone who dares to hurt the supreme leader. And they also have the capability, since they've been investing very heavily in asymmetric means of warfare and technologies generally, and computer network attack and cyber capabilities specifically.
Salufo tells VOA that North Korea is likely investing a higher percentage of its money in building up its cyber attack capabilities than any other country.
What we lack at this stage is foolproof attribution. In other words, we don't have a smoking keyboard that they, in fact, were behind it, or whether or not proxies or those sympathetic to North Korea's causes were behind it, or if someone else altogether is behind it.
But even the North Korean government itself is not denying links to the hacking. Asked if Pyongyang was involved, a spokesman for the government said, wait and see. The hacking paralyzed Sony's corporate email, knocking it and other internal systems completely offline. Sony has since restored some of the affected systems, tapping cybersecurity forensics experts to repair the damage. But some of the damage could be harder to undo. Unreleased copies of five Sony movies, including an Annie remake, were leaked online after the hack, and there are reports the hackers stole personal data, including medical and salary information, of up to tens of thousands of employees. Salufo says the potential for North Korean cyber attacks is only set to increase. Unlike Russia and China, the two countries he says pose the biggest threat when it comes to cyber war, North Korea does not have as much to lose. Alex Villarreal, VOA News, Washington.
Well, that's about all the time we have for International Edition on The Voice of America. You can send me your feedback on Twitter. My username is @Michael_Lippin. My thanks to studio director Tracy Carter, and the engineer was Jimmy Cook. I'm Michael Lippin. Hope you can join me again tomorrow.
This is Today in History. On December 2nd, 1804, Napoleon Bonaparte was crowned France's first emperor since Charlemagne at Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. To show that the Roman Catholic Church was not his overlord, Napoleon was handed the crown by Pope Pius VII, but he placed it on his own head. On this day in 1823, U.S. President James Monroe proclaimed the Monroe Doctrine. The doctrine stated that the United States would not interfere in European wars or internal affairs, but it also expected Europe to refrain from further colonization in the Western Hemisphere. In 1859, radical U.S. abolitionist John Brown was hanged for his deadly raid on Harper's Ferry. In 1908, Emperor Puyi, often referred to as the last emperor, ascended to the Chinese throne. He was only 2 years of age. On this day in 1942, working at the University of Chicago, Italian-born Nobel Prize-winning physicist Enrico Fermi directed the first controlled nuclear chain reaction in history. Fermi's work was part of the Manhattan Project, a secret U.S. wartime project to develop nuclear weapons. In 1947, riots broke out in Jerusalem in response to the approval on November 29th of the UN Partition Plan. The plan would end British rule over the area and divide the land between two independent states, one Jewish and the other Arab. Arabs rejected the plan and it was never fully implemented. In 1954, the U.S. and the Republic of China, Taiwan, signed a mutual defense treaty. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply concerned by the brutality and the increasingly frequent attacks on the civilian population of Beni Territory, North Kivu, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or DRC. Machete and gun-wielding attackers have targeted several villages in the region, leaving almost 200 dead in the last 45 days. The illegal Ugandan armed group, the Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF, and possible others allegedly perpetrated these attacks, which included reported beheadings, mutilations, and rape. The ADF is a rebel group founded by a Ugandan radical Islamist sect in the 1990s. The attacks appeared to target civilians the rebels suspect are providing information about rebel movements to government and United Nations troops. The attacks are the latest in a series of massacres in the region. These atrocities should not go unpunished. The United States calls on the government of the DRC to initiate a prompt, thorough investigation and hold all responsible to account. The United States supports urgent, intensified efforts by the armed forces of the DRC with United Nations Organization Stabilization Mission in the DRC support to protect civilian populations and to eradicate all illegal armed groups in eastern Congo. This includes the ADF and the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda. The United States will continue to support the government and the people of the DRC, as well as the United Nations, in their combined efforts to consolidate peace, security, and stability throughout the country.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage. www.voanews.com/editorials.